The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. Good evening. It helps to be mindful so you can catch that. Last week I gave a talk about trust. Some of it was, most of it was autobiographical, talking about the role and place of trust in my life and how important it is. And today I would like to offer you a different perspective, maybe on the same topic, because perhaps trust is only part of the picture, or trust is not quite it. And what might be more important than trust in terms of the Buddhist path and how Buddhism develops for people? Maybe a little bit softer would be good, because it's a little bit. So is that a little bit better? Okay. So what might be a little more important than having trust is to have the absence of mistrust. And so the question, you know, that's interesting is, what is the difference between having trust versus having the absence of mistrust? It's possible to not have mistrust and also not have trust. Maybe if there's no mistrust, there's no need for trust. And some people are pursuing or feel it's important to have faith, to have trust, to have confidence. And it's often championed as a very important quality in a spiritual life, religious life. But perhaps the reason people are so eager, some people, to have trust and faith or think it's important is because they live with mistrust. They live with not just absence of confidence, but they live with kind of the opposite of confidence. And this idea that it can be valuable to have the absence of something as opposed to having the presence of something is an interesting thing to consider. And I would say that in the higher reaches of the Buddhist path, that the emphasis is not on what is attained, not what is gained, not what you get, but rather the emphasis on what is not there. And sometimes talk about what you let go of, but what is not needed. And it's remarkable sometimes to be in situations where it's clear that so much of what we think we need is no longer needed. I've been spending time with someone who's dying lately, and you know, when you're up close to your time of your death, how much do you need? How much of the stuff in your closet do you need? How much of the things you're trying to attain and do and get do you need? There's a lot of things that fall away, and that falling away, it can be very precious. I remember many years ago, I went to spend time with a woman who had lost her son, and I was sitting with her in her garden, and there was certainly a lot of sadness, but there was something about the poignancy of the moment, of just being there in this beautiful garden with this person, that everything kind of came to a stop, and it was very still. And it felt like nothing was needed. It didn't feel like anything was needed from me in counseling this woman, being with her. What was needed, if anything, was the absence of stuff, just to be there, just to be. And if I had been concerned or worried or strategizing about how to be a good counselor for her and trying to find the right words and what to say, I could have easily filled my mind with worry, concerns, strategies, try to figure things out. And I would have missed the poignancy and the beauty of this silence or the stillness that we had together, just being there in the garden. Nothing was needed. So the absence of things, I think of the absence of things a little bit like if you're an artist, if you're a painter, it's nice to come across a blank canvas. because there's so much you can do with that. If you love to backpack, it's kind of nice, the absence of the snow lets you go into the backcountry. The music, some musicians say their music, the most important part of their music is the silence. The silence allows for everything else to kind of be highlighted. Or if you go to Japan, it's very interesting to see the difference between a flower arrangement in Japan, flower arrangements in the United States. Sometimes in America there's a big bouquets. And in Japan they have a custom of these little niches in the wall of their rooms where it's kind of a very special place where they have maybe a vase and they have one flower. And not the whole bouquet where it's bursting full of colors, but that one flower that flower in and of itself stands out in highlight by the absence of a lot of busyness and other things. And it feels kind of very different feeling of it, the absence. We talk about having a clear mind. I need to clear my mind. It's just so full of confusion and stuff and junk. And it can, in that kind of context, it feels really good, the absence of all this clutter in the mind, to have a clear mind. To be the absence of. And one of the nice things about the absence of something, it doesn't require work. Maybe it requires work to get there, but the absence itself doesn't require anything. So in terms of trust, if trust is an activity that we do, it's work. It's activity, something you have to do. The absence of mistrust, nothing's needed there. Once you don't have it, nothing's needed. You don't have to do any work at all. And that's why in the higher reaches of the Buddhist path, the absence is so important, because one of the things we start discovering in the higher kind of more mature aspects of Buddhism is how the possibility of something really beautiful and poignant that comes not from doing any more stuff, doing more practice, but rather the absence of it, the falling away of it. A clear and open heart doesn't. I also like the expression, an open heart. To have an open heart, there has to be an absence, right? There has to be an absence of being closed. There has to be a space. That in that space, something can happen. So, very occasionally in the ancient Buddhist texts, someone who is spiritually mature is said to be someone who has no faith. Isn't that nice? It has no faith. Also, another way a person is fully mature is described as someone who has nothing. It's called akinshano. It's the word. No thing. No thing person. Person of no thing. And I think this idea of, if you hear that if you follow this path to its maturity, you'll have nothing. Maybe you're going to look for another religion. Because you want to have something to show for yourself. You want to have something. You go over to visit your neighbors and they're involved in a great religion and they have all this accoutrement and stuff that goes along with it. And they say, what do you have? Nothing. Nothing. How long have you been doing this practice? I've been doing it for 25, 30 years, and you have nothing? Nothing to show? But the idea to have nothing, not because it's a diminishing of ourselves, or not because it's a lessening of who we are or anything, impoverishment, but rather because there's a richness in the peace, richness in what happens in an open heart, richness and beauty that happens in a clear mind of what can be there. It's kind of like a blank canvas, as I pointed out, might be very welcoming to an artist because it's full of potential. An artist, likes to have blank canvas. And then once it's done, and painted, some artists will put it away and look for the next blank canvas. Because what's important is not the result of what they do, but what's important is what comes out of them, what's being expressed. And so the same thing, perhaps, in a mature Buddhist spirituality, what's important is not what you have, but rather your capacity to respond, your capacity to what comes out of you, how you are in the world. And so to be left with nothing, isn't that great? It doesn't leave you with nothing, but it leaves you with a much better ability to respond to the world, to meet it in some way. It's also a lot more peaceful. So I'm fond of this kind of analogy or idea that you can look at two people, maybe they're both in the same very difficult situation, very trying situation, and both people seem really patient. And then you go inside each person, or you ask each person, you say to the first person, how do you manage to be so patient in such a difficult situation? Oh, I gritted my teeth, I really kind of had to really reframe the situation and think about it and look at it through a different point of view. I had to, remember we're all going to die soon, and I have to use cell phones as a mindfulness reminder. And they're really great. And, and to do all this stuff, to try to... And so that's nice. And then you ask the other person, what did it take for you to be so patient? And they look at you perplexed. Patient? I wasn't patient. What are you talking about? Why would the second person say that? Why would the second person that you thought was patient say, patience? What? I wasn't patient. He didn't have impatience, right? There was no impatience. He wasn't triggered. He wasn't irritated or frustrated by the situation. It was the absence there, right? And so in that absence, it could look as if the person was patient. But patience for the second person was not an activity. It didn't require any doing. So the mind can be more at ease. The first person needed to do something. So what do you know about absence? What do you know about the value of absence? What do you think about this thing about having nothing? Is this a frightening idea? Discouraging idea? Is this a welcoming idea? I think the answer depends on maybe a little bit, not only who you are, your kind of way of working in the world, but also the perspective in which you bring to it. Sometimes to be told that you'll have nothing in this path, it's kind of insulting. Or it's kind of reinforces ideas that some people have that they're insignificant. They're not worth, they're unworthy. And in that unworthiness, yes, finally I came to a religion that agrees with me. I have nothing. Isn't that great? And I'm good. I'm finally around those people. All these other nobodies. All these other nothings. We're all losers. So it can be heard in that kind of ears. But if you kind of try to do a little bit of the work of turning around a little bit and trying to look at this from the way that might be useful and helpful for you, how is it that this idea that spiritual maturity in Buddhism, how is this idea that the absence of things is the highest benefit you can give yourself? How is it that it's really, how is it, in what way is that attractive to you and meaningful for you? The idea that of absence of doing, absence of the mind having to do, to work, to have something, to be something? Or is it mostly perplexing? Some people's spirituality is deeply rooted in the idea that it's important to love or important to have peace, or to have this, or have this, or have this. But is there something that goes beyond all the having and being? And it's more an absence, the via negativa, the emptying of ourselves. So that's the topic for you. What do you think of that? So what I'd like to suggest, if you're up for it, is if you would turn to two other people near you and share a little bit for you, explore with the three of you. Is there any value for you in this thing of an absence, spirituality of absence? If you don't want to speak, you're welcome to leave. You're also welcome to sit quietly by yourself. And then we'll regather here and continue a discussion here in about 10 minutes. Take about 10 minutes for a little discussion. Okay? So please. So in the earliest teachings of the Buddha, he emphasized the importance of wisdom. But the wisdom that he emphasized was to have wisdom about what you don't need to do anymore. To have wisdom about how the mind works and operates in necessary ways. Or to say it differently, to have wisdom about how we get into trouble with our minds. And then if you have wisdom about that, then you have the opportunity, the possibility of maybe stop doing that. Or stop investing yourself in it unconsciously. This is really important. So to let go of the activities of the mind which get you into trouble. Let go of those activities of the mind which are not necessary, which keep you preoccupied, whatever. And what's nice about this approach to wisdom is that it's not a positive wisdom about, it's not like, not something you have to acquire and get. It's mostly to understand what it is you can disinvest yourself from. Disinvest of what causes suffering. And then what happens after you're free of suffering? What happens when you're no longer doing the activities of your mind that cause you trouble? Some people want to know, because sometimes part of the drive that gets us into trouble is the want to have something, to have definition, to have security, to have an identity, to have things. Because only if we have things, some people will feel safe or feel secure or have, feel something. And the idea of not having anything, just being present and open, is slightly unsettling, because you want to have something to show for it. So in this ancient tradition, Buddhism, teaching of the Buddha, he talked about a list of four things that people invest too much efforts into. Too much mental activity goes into these things. And it's really helpful if we can disinvest ourselves from being preoccupied and caught up in these four things. I think maybe he sees these as the four primary things, or very strong ones. And I'll give them to you in a different order than the traditional order, partly because maybe it's more palpable that way. Palatable that way. So the first is one of the ways we get into trouble is through precepts and religious practice. And so we see that in religions, we see that in Buddhism, where people hold on to and cling to things Buddhist. In some situations they have clothes, you can be a good Buddhist, you have to wear a certain kind of clothes or have certain kinds of paraphernalia with you that shows, or you have to have certain badges or certain status, or there's something to acquire and get. Or the idea of precepts, some people really cling tight to the idea of ethics and precepts as being so important, and how to be safe and how to be right and justified and how to create a sense of myself and other. In religious practices, people are so attached to their religious practices because they're so desperate for some solution, some help, some way of getting out of their suffering, some place out of their loneliness or their despair or their discouragement. And so if only that religious practice can do it. There are many reasons. And Buddhism does not want to discourage ethics, precepts, religious practices. It's a very important part of Buddhism. And there is no spiritual maturity in Buddhism without being ethical. So we're not exactly supposed to abandon precepts. But one of the ways to get caught and cause trouble for yourself is to be too attached to everything to do with religion. Isn't that nice that some religion says that? So with precepts, how it's understood is that ethics, being ethical, is another example of something which involves the absence of something. It's the absence of wanting to cause harm. It's the absence of violence. It's the absence of lying, of stealing, and so forth. It's not a doing. And so that someone who's spiritually mature, living by the precepts, is like the second person who is patient. Are you ethical? No. No. I'm not ethical. As not ethical in the terms of something the person's doing. There's no doing, just how they are. So, looking ethical, behaving ethically is important, but it comes naturally, not out of doing, but out of kind of being. Make some sense? So the Buddha talked about precepts and religious practices as being a source of trouble for people. So be careful about it. The second source of trouble is excessively investing yourself too much, or be too preoccupied or attached to your opinions and your stories. And of course, none of you are, but you can recognize it. But you can recognize it in those other people. And you can see in yourself, perhaps, and in other people sometimes, the extra amount of trouble and suffering and distress it sometimes can cause when people are really caught up in their views, their stories, their ideas. This is how it is. Even sometimes when the stories are true, the fish did get bigger of every telling, the way people hold on to their stories and cling to them for identity, to be right, to be entertaining, to make an impression, to show, there's all kinds of reasons why we hold on to our stories and these views and opinions. But it's a doing. And this is a very interesting thing, the doing of views and opinions. Because if you see that having an opinion is an activity of the mind, then there are some times where you'll see, you don't have to bother. Why would you bother? And what becomes an interesting question or exploration is not what opinion to have about something. What's more interesting is the first question is it necessary to have an opinion here? I've been in contact with someone lately who, in some people's eyes, lives an unethical life, and other people's lives, that person's own eyes and other people's eyes, no, it's not unethical. But so, there are kind of gray areas, or there are different ways, right, that people have on ethics. But I know plenty of people who see what this person does as being unethical. And so I had to kind of consider, do I need to get involved in having an opinion about this person's ethics? Is it necessary? So sometimes it's necessary to have that. Sometimes it's necessary to evaluate and consider and come to a decision. But is it always necessary? Maybe it's not always necessary. Maybe it's possible to meet someone and not carry with us the judgments. Even if the judgments are true, good, appropriate to have, do we need to have them? So the question is, do we need to have the judgments is maybe more important than what is your opinion? And I don't think we ask ourselves that enough. So next time you're with someone, and rather than asking them their opinion about something, ask them, do you think we need to have an opinion about this? And have a discussion about the need. You know, is it really necessary to have it? Someone lent me a book today. It's called Life After Murder. And it's a woman, a journalist, who spent 4 or 5 years getting to know 5 men in San Quentin who were in the jail because of murder. And she talks about, she follows them through a process of, she calls it redemption. And, they spent decades in jail. So she, I don't know if she follows it through them, but she records or learns their story and how they come out. And I've been to San Quentin and been with people who are murderers. And do I, that's a pretty heavy thing to do, right? Do I need to judge them? Do I need to be involved and have an opinion? Some people would say it's natural to have an opinion. So, you know, you should have an opinion. But I'm sitting there in a room with these people, and that's not what it's about. There's no point for me to have an opinion, a judgment about them. That's not what the story is. That's not the time for it. I'm meeting them in a very different setting, very different situation. And not only is it not a time for an opinion, it's not helpful for me or for them. So stories, opinions, views, being right, there's a time for it and not time for it. And so that's another one of these places we get in trouble. And another place where we can have an absence of it is really, really helpful. The third place of trouble is around all the ideas we can have about ourself, the stories and views and opinions about ourself, subcategory of the story thing. And to have a self, to be caught up in self-identity. We all have some kind of identity, but do we have to always go around with it? Do we have to always kind of wave the flag? In Buddhism, they have the idea of the identity, conceit is like a flag. You go, look at me over here. This is who I am. One of the beautiful things, one of the great things I think I've experienced of sitting in a meditation hall with other people is the normal kind of social identities that people kind of relate by, or games, social games people play, fall away. It's difficult for them to survive on a meditation retreat because it's a lot of work to prop up your identity. It's a lot of work to try to be someone all the time. And it's nice not to be someone. It's nice just to be. And so retreats are a great place to learn that. And then it's interesting to be with other people who, you know, have all that kind of social identities and kind of fall away. And there's so many kind of stories we tell about ourselves, not just identities about who we are, but also how we are. You know, I'm worthless, and I'm a bad person, and, you know, I'm the best person, and everybody else better realize it. And I'm going to make sure they do. And, you know, it's a whole stuff, right? So to study this, to understand how we get in trouble around self-identity, and then to learn that maybe there are plenty of times we don't need it. Just like we don't have to judge someone else all the time. Always, we can just meet someone, maybe murderers sometimes, and just meet them without the history, the story, what happened, and what you think about it. Just meet them. So the same way, maybe you can do that for yourself. You can just meet the world, be in the world, without a story, without being someone. I need to prove yourself, disprove yourself, defend yourself. Just be. And then the fourth of these places people get into trouble is around sensual pleasure. Or it's probably more useful maybe to expand it out to call the pursuit of comfort. But, you know, pleasure, comfort is a very big driving force for people. I think more than most people realize. Some people kind of bristle at the idea that Buddhism says you should give up attachment to sensual pleasures because I don't have a problem with sensual pleasures. But, you know, it's kind of embedded in many, many, many people's kind of moment-to-moment choices about how they live their lives. And so it's an area where people get in trouble. I mean, it's the obvious kind of trouble that people get into when it's, you know, dramatic pursuit of pleasure or addiction or lust or something. But the very preoccupation with being comfortable, preoccupation with pleasure, is an activity of the mind. And it's tiring. It's an activity of the mind which is not always needed. And so you have the ability to put that down, to stop wanting pleasure, stop wanting comfort. You have the ability to stop wanting when you're uncomfortable. This is one of the things that I learned from my experience on meditation retreats. I found that my early years of meditation retreats, they were rather uncomfortable. My knees hurt and things like that. And I learned that my mind could be peaceful if I didn't get involved with the discomfort, if I just left it alone. Just left it alone. And it took quite a while to learn that it was okay to do. I had all these strategies and all this motivation to fix and do and react and judge and be upset and have self-pity. So plenty of doing that I was capable of. I'm not capable of it, I did. And then what I learned slowly, because I did a lot of these retreats, was I didn't have to do those things. And then came a point where I began to appreciate and value the quality of my mind, the state of my heart, when it was at peace, when it wasn't in reacting to the discomfort or pursuing wanting comfort, and I could just be uncomfortable and be peaceful. The absence of the reactivity and all the doing of the mind, the drive for pleasure, the drive for comfort. So these five areas are areas in our life where it's really useful to learn how to live with the absence of them. We don't have to live without them all the time, just put them aside once and for all. There is a time and place for rituals and, ethics and religious practices. There's a time and place for our stories. There's a time and place for having a self-identity, and there's a time and place for sensual pleasures, for sure. But you have the ability to be at ease and comfortable and enjoy the absence of all those things. And that's one of the things that meditation practice is helping us to do. Meditation practice is one of those places where it's not about attaining something or getting something. It's more like letting go of things, divesting yourself, doing less, discovering how little you need to do. And in that absence of doing, there's meaning. In the absence of doing, there's freedom. In the absence of doing, there is a different perspective on our lives that then we can bring with us and see our lives in a new way. So maybe you don't need to trust. Some of you are troubled by last week's talk. It's too religious. Faith. I knew it. Today, instead of faith, instead of trust, better than faith, better than trust, is the absence of mistrust. May you be well, you see, it's hard, you know, to use all these negatives. Then people don't, you know, it doesn't work either. So we say, may you be filled with trust. But what I really mean is, may you have the absence of mistrust. It might look the same. And in that absence of mistrust, may you find deep, abiding, satisfying sense of peace. Thank you.